It is a pleasure to have Mark Brennan, CEO of Serato Gold, join us today. Serato Gold is an emerging mid-tier gold producer, mid-tier low-cost gold producer operating and building projects in South America. Mark is a veteran in the mining industry with over 30 years of experience. Prior to Serato Gold, he was CEO of Sierra Metals and CEO of Largo Resources. Mark is a consummate builder. Him and his team have consistently delivered growth and returns to shareholders. During his tenure at Sierra Metals, delivered 2.4 times return there and basically built a Largo to a $1 billion company while he was there, and then Desert Sun Mining, a 25x return. We've had the pleasure of having numerous conversations with Mark, where we're also investors, and it's for us, you know, this is, it's a tough business, Mark. There's no question about that. Mining's a tough business, but to do it repetitively, and this is not, you know, you're out there building and delivering, and it's a challenge. You know, it's a challenging industry at the best of times, but you know, that track record and the team you've built, incredible. And thank you for taking the time to sit down with us.
Hey, it's my great pleasure, and you know, some would call us masochists, but we see tremendous good upside over the long term.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so Mark, maybe I'll kick it off. And there's obviously, you know, you had news overnight, but why don't we first start off with the gold price and just broader your broader thoughts on gold? Maybe you could give us your thoughts on where we sit right now and just some tailwinds that you're seeing.
Well, I think I heard a point brought up earlier. I mean, in this type of environment, one would usually expect to see lower gold prices, but obviously there's a lot of interest in gold, and there's buying coming in, irrespective of the inflationary environment in which we're in. You know, whether that's the fact that you know, we're seeing significant central bank buying, as you guys have highlighted in the past, and that continues. And basically, we're seeing a challenge a little bit coming to treasury offerings, and you know, the treasury offering that was held last week was less than a glittering success. You know, there's more treasuries offerings being contemplated in the short term, which people are nervous about. And I think what you're starting to see is well known that the Chinese have been buying less and less of these offerings, and they've been putting more money into gold, amongst others. So I think that there are other types of activities taking place, particularly, you know, one, okay, you got a safe haven issue. If the events in the Middle East were to expand or to become regional, et cetera. But then I think on a monetary basis, people are looking at you know, just the tremendous budget deficits that are building in the U.S. and the, you know, the what seems to be continued unbridled spending that is forcing a lot of central banks in the world to move away perhaps from some of their holdings in dollars and moving it into gold, which I think is going to continue.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is like you're starting to see a chain of events happen, and right now feels like the Fed's basically locked in a bit here, right? You got inflation still; they're not out of the woods just yet, but you have two wars on the horizon with uncertain end dates. It's a very challenging time.
It is difficult, and with that, you've got a significantly widening deficit, you know, budget deficit, which is fiscal deficit, which is, you know, is very, very substantive.
Absolutely, and you know, the one chart, and I'll try to bring it into the nest here, that really stood out to me is just how resilient gold has been. Just in the past, or even with real yields rising, like typically, right, you see gold fall, but it just shows you how much is baked in. And I think one aspect of what's, you know, what's holding the gold price historically, you have the U.S. side, but the other side of this as well is the significant emerging market buying. And I think that's been a unique characteristic here that has really held gold up.
Indeed. I mean, you're seeing buying from everywhere, right? Which is, and again, it's a small market, right? At the end of the day, gold, the gold companies, they're all pretty, it's a pretty small market compared to most other sectors.
For sure. Scott, you want to kick in with the questions? Yeah. Thanks, Mark, for that overview.
Mark, before we get started on kind of some macro and talk about your operations, I'm just wondering if have you seen any good research to kind of you think explains why governments are buying at kind of unusually high levels for this time in the cycle and this time of year?
I haven't seen anything specific, quite honestly. Most of it has been more through commentaries and modest commentaries as opposed to any specific reports. But there's been a lot. I mean, it's across a broad spectrum of banks, funds, endowments, sovereigns. There's been a lot of discussion on this, but I haven't seen anything specific in terms of reports.
Yeah, I'm sure it's one of those things we won't know until in hindsight we'll know. But there's a reason, obviously, and it's good to take notice.
For sure. Well, again, I think I think people are looking at gold as having a fiscal haven status, more than it has in more recent times.
Got it. Now, Mark, I know South America has a rich is endowed with many riches, copper, lithium, gold and silver, obviously. Now you operate in Brazil and Argentina and South America and Canada as well. I just was hoping you could talk a bit about the operating environment in those three places, similarities, differences, what your expectations are for the future. We can kind of take it however you want.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have a long history of working in South America and predominantly in Brazil. We've seen some. I actually lived in Brazil in the mid '80s when they went through a very high inflationary cycle when rates got as high as inflation got as high as somewhere in the region of about 1,000% until they kind of came in and got their house in order. Since my involvement with Desert Sun, where I was one of the founders of Desert Sun, which we sold to Yamana for $700 million. We initiated the development of Desert Sun in 2002. But since that time, whether it's been under the government of Lula or Dilma, or whoever it may be, and now back to Lula, excuse me. The reality is that it's a great place to work. The government has been fairly stable in terms of its fiscal regime, in terms of its macro policies, in terms of its approach to mining. So from that perspective, I love Brazil. I think Brazil is probably one of the best jurisdictions in the world to work. It's heavily endowed, as you mentioned, with mineral resources. And the reality is that in terms of the comparative exploration density that you see in other jurisdictions in North America, et cetera. There's still a lot to be found in Brazil. It's still somewhat virginal compared to North America. Particularly now, if you look at the currency where you're nearing 5-to-1 exchange rate with the US dollar, it's just a highly, highly competitive environment to work. I mean, again, on the macro policies, the government are mining friendly. They've retained the mining laws and been consistent with the mining laws for pretty much the last 15, 20 years. The micro policy, the dollar is obviously a real strong attraction with the value to the real right now. And then on top of that, you have a lot of mining expertise in Brazil. So I think mining in Brazil is a wonderful, wonderful place to operate. I think in terms of if I look at South down in Argentina, we're seeing some of the challenges that you saw in Brazil in the 80s. And I think they've kind of come to a point where there needs to be concrete and solid action. As everyone is aware, there's an election taking place on Sunday. My view is I don't expect to see a clear winner from this election. What it'll probably lead to is a runoff of the top two candidates on November 19th. However, I think that what people are all in agreement with is that subsequent to the election on Sunday, you're probably going to see a fairly significant devaluation of the official currency. And then on top of that, I think that over hopefully not a too long period of time, you're going to see the removal of currency controls and different currencies for different operating sectors. And that'll have an extremely, the combination will have an extremely positive impact in terms of the ability to mine in Argentina. Again, Argentina endowed with substantial wealth, and probably, in my view, you know, less explored than Brazil in many facets. So from that perspective, you have a few more issues that you need to deal with in Argentina than I've seen in Brazil. Unions are extremely powerful. Government tends to be a little bit more proactive in terms of both at a federal level and at a provincial level when they're dealing with mining companies and operations and such. So they tend to meddle a little more than I'd see in Brazil. But I'm very hopeful that with the resolution of the election that we have now, whoever comes to power will be able to come in and really have a strong mandate to change things up dramatically, because there's no longer room to allow things to spiral. You know, as you've probably seen, inflation is at 138%. You know, that's up from probably 50-60% less than a year ago. The peso, the official peso, is now at 350. I think people are expecting, you know, by next week it'll be at 700 on the basis of a devaluation post the election. So we'll see. But again, what's really important is that if we see the devaluation of the official rate, that'll be amazing for mining companies. It'll be amazing for the value of the assets, for profitability. Getting rid of currency controls, I think you'll see a whole swarm of new investment into Argentina, and predominantly a lot of that in the mining sector or the natural resource sector. So it has a lot of promise in a global environment where you know people are looking for resources and Argentina has an abundance of resources that perhaps haven't been as exploited because of the problems they've had on a macro or micro basis. But I think those will probably, if they can show some form of change, I think you'll see a very rapid influx, which will mean not only, you know, do we anticipate strong profitability improvements, but also probably stronger valuations for the assets themselves, because they're not being devalued, due one to the currency and the regime, and then two, due to the fact that they're freely tradable. So I think some very positive things will come out of Argentina post this election. If I look at Quebec and Canada, you know, obviously we saw some a very recent Supreme Court decision on Friday, where the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that the federal government had overstretched its mandate to look at imposing environmental concerns. I don't think that's going to have a significant impact in the short term. I think that, you know, the provincial governments will retain the last word and they'll work with the federal framework. But I'll say, you know, in Quebec, for example, it's quite a long process to move from permitting, you know, from a permitting process. It's about a 3-year process where if you look at Brazil, you know, we're probably looking at about a year and a half. Argentina, probably likewise, you know, in that year to year and a half process. So, you know, Quebec, obviously, and Canada, much more, let's call it a stable jurisdiction, you know, a first world jurisdiction. But it has its challenges because of the tighter controls that it's seeing now on the environmental and regulatory side. Obviously, all that stuff is good for the long term, but at the same point, it poses challenges, particularly to junior companies. If you're a large company and you have multiple assets, it's not so difficult to go and put one on hold or slow track one project. But if you're, you know, a single asset company or a smaller company, you want your assets to be moving ahead as quickly as possible. So those are the, you know, but obviously, you know, very good jurisdiction to work in Quebec, you know, very stable, very, you know, government friendly. And once you are actually in the development process.
That's a very helpful roundup. You know, I would just want to go back to Argentina for a minute, because you mentioned some of the issues that an operator would have to deal with, you know, inflation, capital controls. But despite all of those, it's remained a pretty hot area for deals and mining activity. There's lots of operators, there's ones that have come in, they're spending lots of money there. Is that just the geology's?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, and first of all, on the lithium side, you know, it's attracted a lot of attention. You know, and you have some very significant projects, and you know, you have some really big projects, copper, gold, you know, throughout Argentina, and you know, our neighbor Anglo has produced 8 million ounces to date at Cerro Vanguardia. Newmont, you know, to the northwest of us, have about 8 million ounces to produce, you know, at a run rate around 350,000 ounces a year. So it is very attractively endowed in terms of resource. And to your point, you know, you have seen companies, particularly on the lithium side, they've kind of overlooked the macro and other policies. But I know, for example, groups like Lundin, groups like other groups are looking at potentially coming into Argentina as soon as they feel that the macro picture has kind of gained a little bit more stability, and that's gonna, to your point, there's been a lot of activity already. I think that'll multiply, you know, numerous fold once you get some of the issues that the wrinkles you have right now ironed out.
Do you think it require capital controls to go away, or do you think it doesn't even have to go there for some of these guys that are watching and waiting to say it's worth it to start?
A devaluation of the currency will go a long way, right? And you know, what happens right now is we're selling gold at a low price and all our expenses are at a high price. So you know, when you see a devaluation on the official rate, all of a sudden companies are going to be far more profitable. So that starts to give you a lot more leeway. It really means you can start to grow your assets and build your assets. So people will be attracted by that, particularly if they're looking at a longer term to actually see if they're looking to build and grow operations. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I mean, people have to get their money out, particularly if that money has been coming in from abroad. Investors expect a return, and they expect that to be returned in you know, in kind. So I think currency controls. Will you know, I think it's recognized that they have to, it's limiting foreign investment, and what they need now is more than anything is foreign investment, and so it's kind of a bit of an oxymoron that the policies that they have in place are limiting that what they most need. So I think that on a twofold basis, you know, for the investors and for the companies, you know, they really want to see the ability to bring money out. And then on the other side, you know, if they were to impose that, I think all the governments recognize that the only way you're going to bring money in is by removing it. So I think there's, no matter again which party is involved, I think what you'll see is probably, you know, within 18 months, if not before, and probably between 18 now and 18 months, you'll see some reduction in those controls. But I think it's probably something that everybody recognizes they have to leave, that have to go away. And you know, no one more than the World Bank, that, you know, has been a sponsor to Argentina and a significant you know, supporter of Argentina. I think they've now come to the point where they're putting a lot of pressure on the government to you know, to remove those currency controls. So I think it's coming from all angles, which means that hopefully within a not too long period of time, they'll be removed. But I think the biggest concern that people have is once you remove those currency controls, you will see an immediate spike in inflation. And that's, you know, that could have some debilitating impact on particularly the lesser wealthy population. And that's, I think, a big concern for everybody. So I think there's going to be some kind of you know, some kind of rollout of programs that'll reduce that gradually or over time.
Mark, just on that, it's just fascinating in terms of, like, you know, having this political moment that literally could, you know, unlock value. Maybe just in terms of how you're seeing your own asset, but just across the board, what kind of discount right now, you could talk in broad terms, but what kind of discount right now do you think Argentina is getting to, say, a similar asset in another jurisdiction? And then, you know, like, I guess once we see that lifted, surely there will be this valuation pop that happens on that, you know, around that day.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, I think there's a twofold impact here, right? One is that we sell gold at a depreciated level and our expenses at our high level. So immediately you'll see, you know, the profitability of those mines improving. And then second of all, removing currency controls, you know, up until recently, and things have spun so rapidly in downward, where basically, you know, as you saw after the runoff in August, you know, the there was an immediate depreciation by the government of 18%, and I think that extended to probably closer to 25% by the market. But in terms of I'd say that probably prior to, from say June, the previous 6 to 12 months, you're probably looking at a depreciation or devaluation of somewhere close to 50%. And I think that's probably more significant now. You know, I haven't seen too many transactions, too many M&A activity or activity in terms of transactions. But I would have to say probably at this point, you're probably looking at, you know, anywhere from 50 to 80% discounts for Argentinian assets. But I think that'll change I think that can change very, very quickly.
Very helpful. Thank you, Mark.
Now, I was wondering if we could kind of get into the business of mining exploration a bit. So you recently had a drilling sample come back in Argentina. This is one of the reasons why people are in Argentina, that you guys called bonanza grades of gold. It was basically as high as about 430 grams per ton. Now, when you're developing a mine, or even simply exploring for gold, and you hit an intercept like this, I'm just curious, how does it change your future drilling plans or your understanding of the deposit? Like, what has that meant for you in Argentina?
Well, I mean, it's been very material in terms of, you know, it's a signal that there's potentially a system or a structure in place that can endow that type of gold. And so what we have found in this particular area, which we call Palo Andrea, which is around Chulungo, which we've been mining recently and probably for the last 9 months or so, is actually, you know, we've brought in some consultants and our geological team have focused very much on this area. And we have a consultant out of Chile who's a longstanding gold geologist, structural geologist who was working with Placer Dome in the old days, but a very well-known and highly respected individual. And I think what he would define it as is this a game changer for MDN. And why? Because basically he can see, you know, these structures at surface. He can see the structures in terms of the groundwork that we've done. And we believe this area, Palo Andrea, you know, you can't, you know, we've had three or four fairly significant holes coming out of this area. We have, I say, Baratina mining, where we're mining right now. We have Chulungo. We have other areas, you know, three or four areas that we're mining. And so what it's done is made us look at, okay, what's the bigger picture here? And as I say, I think that we have only mined at, you know, very close to surface. We've only drilled fairly shallow holes. So you know, right now, this is certainly a hotspot for us in terms of drilling. Now, you know, in terms of, you know, we are the new kids on the block in Argentina. We, as you mentioned, we've got a huge land position. I think it's, you know, 333,000 hectares. I think it's the size of Rhode Island. It's a big land mass, which we'd never be able to own in Nevada, for example, which is a very similar geological setting with these classic, with these classic low sulfidation epithermal systems.
This space was downloaded via spacesdown.com. Visit to download your spaces today.
So the reality is that it gives us a lot of hope that you know, we've always been mining here at pretty high grade. You know, we're putting 5 grams per ton material through the plant, and this is surface material. As you know, we made an application for our underground permit probably about 2 or 3 months ago. We expect to get that hopefully before the end of the year. And so looking at our operations here, you know, the underground is where we see some again, very high grade material, 10, 12 grams that we're looking to chase. But it certainly will change our focus to what we believe is a very significant open pit, low or shallow mining opportunity to go after. And if you look at at Yamana, now Pan American, or Anglo with Cerro Vanguardia, or Newmont with Cerro Moro, or Cerro Negro, excuse me. The reality is that they find lots of these pits, and we haven't found one for quite some time. So this for us could be just a real game changer, as our consultant has highlighted. So we're very excited by what's going on there.
Now, as I think just high level, have you seen in the past, like you have a mine plan and you're mining, then you find this high grade area. Can you pivot and say you mine this higher grade earlier? And so basically your grades are higher now than they would have been before. And so you can decrease your costs that way. You can increase your profitability. Like, does that happen?
Sure. I mean, you know, what I always say about Argentina and MDN in particular, you know, is that this is still a startup operation for us. I mean, we've owned it since 2020. We've done a great job in terms of taking our production from 22,000 ounces when we bought it up to approximately 60,000 ounces this year. And in terms of the what we're also very proud of is we're one of the lowest cost producers in Argentina now, even though we're producing such a smaller amount of ounces than our peers. But what I say here is that, you know, when you look at, there's a slide in our presentation that shows how the different mines in our jurisdiction and the Deseado Massif have basically have looked at open pit and heap leach. Some have looked at going directly to open, sorry, underground and open pit. And so we're still trying to figure out who we are, who we're going to be when we grow up. But what I'll say is that, we're now just developing an area to the north called Calandrias Norte. We're starting, the heap leach is now starting to be normalized and that's starting to increase our production that we started, we started that facility in July. So the reality is that we're still trying to figure out our strategy in terms of how do we mix the open pit, the heap leach, and the underground. But what we do know is that this is, just like Calandrias Norte, where we have, probably a good 50,000 ounces running at 8 to 10 grams per ton. Basically what we're looking at is that this will be another harbinger to drive that open pit process. And it looks like it's going to be quite large. And that for us is very important because in Argentina, and particularly in the Deseado Massif, you have lots of snaky veins, small non-continuous veins, and we're starting to find that we're looking at an area that looks like it has some real meat on it, and that's very critical.
That's really helpful. Now I wanted to move a bit to the financing and some of the milestones to help people who may not know the mining industry that well how to. When is a project de-risked, and maybe talk about your news because this fits into this. So you announced that your project financing tender was oversubscribed. So can you just talk about kind of how project financing works? Why is it so important to bringing a mine to production, and just maybe the details of what this means for
yeah,
Cerrado?
For sure. I mean, this is a huge asset for us, and something that is not. I don't think the market fully understands it, but the reality here is that in what is a very, very awful environment, and probably one of the worst market environments I've seen for junior mining companies in my career, this essentially shows the potential to bring a mine into production. And so as you're well aware, in April of last year, we went out and we tendered to find export credit agencies that we'd be prepared to fund the Monte del Carmo project, and we ended up with four or five different agencies that were prepared to go forward. We decided to work with the UK and UKEF, which is their export credit agency, and they've agreed to support the Monte del Carmo project to the tune of up to $190 million for 70% of the capital required for the project. Now we will not need $190 million, but at the same point, it's available to us, and maybe we'll look at that for future phases. For example, if we're looking at perhaps bringing solar power in, if we're looking at the electrification of the fleet, something maybe we would consider, uses of capital for in the future. But the nice thing here is that let's say my view here is that if we put a big pot together with all the capital, everything that we need for the foreseeable future in a pot. Let's say that's inclusive, including the capital to build the project, including working capital, insurance, and interest costs, amongst other things. You know, we could see a pot maybe of $200 million, and what they're saying is they would contribute $140 million to that pot of $200 million. Now, what we would look at is we've already announced that we have Sprott, who are Sprott Streaming and Royalties, who are very supportive of us and the projects we have. And they've already come out publicly and said that they're prepared to look at, $50, $60 million for our project. So what's very encouraging here is with these two entities combined as part of our capital stack, they've largely accounted for most of the capital that we require. So equity, I'm not sure we're going to get away without having any equity raised. But first of all, we'll have most of the capital stack accounted for. Second of all, our cost of capital, when you deal with export credit agencies, our cost of capital is foreseen to be less than 7% all in. And we're looking at a facility that will probably be somewhere in the range of about 8 years with a 2-year principal holiday and then a 6-year amortization. So the terms and the conditions of that funding are extremely attractive, which is also another very significant thing. So, combined with the fact that we're looking for our permit, our construction permit to be granted by the Tocantins, agency, we're hoping that'll be granted before the end of the year. We will be in a position X funding to start construction immediately. This is very, very material and I think very significant for the company and an asset. The actual facility itself, in my view, is a very valuable asset that people aren't considering.
Yeah, Mark.
No, Mark, I was wondering, I wanted to take this opportunity to ask you if you could give us kind of a general feel for where funding rates are nowadays on the debt side with where interest rates have gone. Like if you're getting project funding, what kind of interest rate are we looking at to get you to that cost of capital rate?
And just to tack on that, like 7%, it's very attractive right now. Maybe you can fill that out for us, but that's a very attractive setup for you guys.
I mean,
as you said, it's an asset.
Yeah. I mean, export credit funding has a motivation for twofold. One is there's a general principle globally for the governments of the world to be responsible for global development and growth. And particularly in countries where potentially you could see more infrastructure being built, et cetera. The second thing is they're obviously trying to drive business for their constituents and for the companies within their jurisdiction. And so basically what they require and what UKEF are requiring is that we have 40% of the materials, services equipment to come from UK companies, and we're very comfortable that in Brazil that we can also see that being fairly easily met. So we don't have a big issue with that. The funding, if you ask me if we were looking at other types of funding, I mean, if you're looking at private equity type funding, it would be 14% without a doubt. If you're looking at other bank project funding, you're probably north of 10%. So it is extremely attractive. Also, the terms on the funding is very attractive, duration and how that's structured. So we're thrilled that the UK government are looking to provide us with support. Now we have to meet, we have to make sure that everything that we've claimed and which we're providing them is as advertised, which again we don't feel we have any problems with, which kind of also just brings one point that I want to just focus on or highlight is that we have a feasibility study coming out for Brazil in the next 2 weeks, and while I don't know the exact numbers and I'm those are brought together later in the process, what I do know is that Brazil will be a best of breed project. In terms of any projects in South America or almost globally, for projects that are producing 100,000 ounces, it will be one of a best of breed projects. That means it will be low capex. It'll be very rapid return on capex. A very strong life of mine, a strong cash flow generation, strong EBITDA generation. So in all high grade in all parameters, this is going to be an exceptional project. And we're waiting 2 weeks. 2 weeks from now, we'll be able to come out and announce those numbers. I have to believe that combined, with the fact that we'll have a very strong line to funding. And we will announce by probably early November, we will announce the banks that we're actually using. And I'll highlight as well that for the banks, not only are we have one bank that will be responsible for one international, very well-known bank, highly regarded bank that'll be responsible for Brazil, but also included in the press release we issued overnight is we'll have another bank, a very highly regarded, well-known bank that also is looking to fund our project in Quebec. And I know we forget a lot about Quebec, but that's another value driver that I think is just lost in the whole equation. The reality is, for I think people, when we announce the bank that will be involved in helping with that funding, I think people are going to stand up and say, "Wow, why are these guys getting involved?" So we've got some really good stuff. It's a tough environment, but everything will be led by the feasibility that we're going to publish in the next 2 weeks.
That's a big catalyst ahead. So 2 weeks, and just to confirm, so you guys are looking for the Brazilian project first production in 2025. So things move quickly.
Yeah, I think we're looking probably late 25 makes a lot of sense.
Got it. Thank you.
So, Mark, my kind of takeaway from all this is, as a shareholder, is when you look at all the funding needs and your current market cap and everything, it sounds like you're comfortable that, with a little bit of equity on top, you can fund these projects and kind of move them forward at this stage, even in a difficult market for mining.
Indeed. I mean, I think, hopefully, if people recognize that this project is best of breed, which I think it'll be very difficult to refute. Hopefully we get some kudos for that, but it is a tough market. But irrespective of the market, we feel that we'll be able to create and provide accretion of value to our shareholders, no matter what we have to do going forward. And I'd say that probably with this funding in place, it puts us, pretty much at the front of the line of companies that will actually build mines in the near term.
Mark, I was hoping you'd talk a little bit about your longer term plan, because I think it's a bit unique among miners. Usually it's like, okay, we're going to put out a feasibility. We're hopeful these intercepts will come through, and that's kind of all there is. But you have a like multi-year plan of, okay, we build this project. We have some cash flow. We take it. We put it here. Could you maybe just walk people through that plan where you're talking about, okay, where does Brazil fit in? Then we start looking at Canada. I think that'd be helpful.
Even before that, and I didn't mention Scott, but I should mention that, as part of this funding, I mentioned that we're going to probably, say the capex comes in approximately $150 million, and we'll probably look at a loan of around $200 million, somewhere in that kind of range, I'm guessing, which includes working capital, but that'll include probably about $10 million of exploration drilling pre-production. And so, our project has probably not had, $10 million of exploration drilling in Brazil since we've owned it, or maybe very little more. But the reality is that so the first and foremost is both with Brazil and with Argentina, these are still discovery assets. And that's very important to note. A lot of companies go out and they drill and they drill and they drill, and then they sell their assets to the company and away they go. Our strategy has been we've got really good economics on what we have. Let's take that to a production scenario where we can generate cash to continue our exploration. So I'd say the first growth path that we see, which is still very much alive and well, is substantial potential for resource growth in both Brazil and Argentina, because they are discovery assets. And they, in Brazil, we probably have 50 targets or 60 targets different areas that we want to go and drill. In Argentina, you know, we probably have six or seven that are real live, potentially significant contributors to resource growth. So that's the first step. But you know, I want to just make sure that people don't ignore that because it's a really important step. The second thing I'll say is, yes, we're going to look to bring Brazil into production. We will look to grow our production in Argentina, look to be generating substantial cash flow from both operations. Now, what we do with those cash flows, we don't know. And we made the acquisition of a project in Quebec, an iron ore project, largely because we know it exceptionally well. We think it's a very it's a very substantive asset that we can drive if necessary. You know, what we're looking at is you know, that project, due to the environmental legislation and permitting regulations, probably doesn't get into a construction phase until 2026 at the earliest. So there's a lot that can happen between now and then. Do we retain it? Do we spin it off? What I do know about that asset is that we can probably expend less than 1 year's cash flow generated from Brazil as our equity contribution to that project. And that project has a 20-year mine life where it'll generate something in the region of about $350 million a year of cash flow based on a third of its resource that it has today. So there's that potential carrot. There's that potential nice asset that we can use. You know, we've had some conversations with people where they say, well, you're a precious metal company, remain a precious metals company. That's certainly an option. But we also have this optionality where you know, many gold companies are no longer gold companies. And you know, the fact is many companies are becoming copper gold companies, where copper leads as opposed to the gold side. You know, many gold companies in the past lack minerals. IAM Gold, you know, these guys actually had very strong contributions from non-gold assets that actually drove most of their profitability for a long time. And lack minerals is an old name, but that is now really mostly American Barrick's strongest assets that they have today. So the reality is that you know, we're really looking to drive cash flow. We have that optionality. We don't, you know, the returns to shareholders is very important to us. And really we'll see how that evolves. But to your point, we certainly have a perspective that, you know, 5 years from now, we could be generating $500 million of cash flow. Which I'd have to believe would be a multiple of our 50 million market cap today. And we wouldn't need a huge amount of capital to get us new capital to get us there, or new equity in particular to get us there. So you know, it's optionality but there is potential here for long-term growth, not only from development growth, but also from resource growth.
Mark, what I like hearing the most is it certainly seems, looking at your history in the mining industry, you're not content to just stay in a lane and say, I do gold. That's what I do. I do silver. You basically move throughout different commodities because you're looking for the return, not necessarily whatever the commodity is. Is that fair?
That's
to say?
Very fair to say. I'll tell you, Scott, my team that I'm working with in Brazil, who helped build a very sophisticated and very challenging and very complex vanadium project, you know, being gold players. They're all very, very happy to be back in gold where they started, you know, as building the Anglo's Jacobina mine, and then rebuilding it for Desert Sun, and then being at Yamana. So they love being back in the gold space. But, you know, as a junior company, and I think as any form of mineral company, the reality is that you have to find the right assets. The assets are everything, as long as you have a good team. I mean, the assets are going to drive value, and as long as you can find, you know, a good asset, you know, it makes a lot more sense to be focused on driving a strong asset than concentrating on a sector where you have mediocre assets. Having you know, first quartile, top 5, top 10% assets within their sector is an extremely valuable thing.
Mark, is the idea more? Go ahead, Dwayne.
Oh, thanks, thanks. Yeah, I just had a quick question here, Mark. I mean, or more of a comment. So is the idea here that you're, you know, over time you're acquiring these high value assets, and then you have the optionality here to either hold on to it for the long term, or perhaps sell it for a higher price in the near future?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Dwayne, you know, if you look, for example, at our project in Quebec, you know, right now it seems to be a time where we're not seeing a lot of interest in the iron ore sector, although iron ore prices have sold out, you know, are very strong. I mean, you're running at you know, 110, 115 bucks per ton. Our cost of production in Quebec would be about $45 per ton. So the reality here is that we're not, you know, we a lot can happen, but we've seen a lot of significant interest in that asset. And again, we are purveyors or we are custodians of investors' wealth and investors' shareholder returns. That's our numero uno game. And the reality is that, yeah, I could easily see ourselves not owning this asset by 2026. But who knows? If we own it, we own it. And if we don't, we don't. But we see the value here. You know, in our PEA that we completed in 2022, you know, we saw an NPV of $1.6 billion. Remove the vanadium and maybe you're at $1.2 billion. But this is, again, an exceptional project that has exceptional value that one day may or may not be in Cerrado Gold. We will have to wait and see.
Now, last one for me, Mark. I just noticed you had a good slide in your deck that looked at the history of Largo, you know, one of the assets you built. And I noticed that the initial PEA had a net present value of, like, you know, a little more than $50 million. And then a few years later, you did an updated PEA that was 10x the NPV. So it went from $50 million to $500. Just wondering if you could give a little perspective. Does this come down to where you were talking about some of these projects are still exploration projects, where as you're developing them and funding, you're still drilling, and so that can lead to big re-ratings in the scope of the projects and the resource?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at our presentation, you'll see that you know, we basically we've drilled 85,000 meters in Cerro Alto, which is where the development asset is. We have a property which is about 82,000 hectares. Cerro Alto is less than 1,000 hectares of that 82,000. As I mentioned earlier, we probably have more than 50 targets on that property. Now, I didn't go into it because it's a little bit longer, but it's an interesting story here. We were brought this project by two geologists that I've known for 30 years. And basically those two geologists are responsible for the discovery, growth, and the size of a project called Volta Grande. Volta Grande today is 7.5 million ounces. It's owned by Belo Sun. It happens to be located in Para in the jungle of Brazil. That's not a good thing. And we'll have very difficult challenges, and we know it'll have difficult challenges to get built. However, the reality is when those guys, you know, I've known them for 30 years. In 2002, they thought the project was going to go from 2 million ounces to 7.5. They've got it there. So the reality is that these are smart guys. When they brought us our project at Monte do Carmo, they thought that they would be north of 5 million ounces. Now, we did our diligence. You know, as I mentioned to you, my team are a gold team. They come from Anglo. They don't know whether it's going to be 5 million ounces, but we certainly know it's going to be a lot more. We believe and we hope it's going to be a lot more than 1.3 million ounces where we are today on a global basis. So yes, drilling is going to be a huge component of this project. I think if we only show up with 3 million ounces on this project, I would be disappointed. And again, if you look at this, there's a specific slide in our presentation. 85,000 meters drilled at Cerro Alto, less than 6,000 meters of drilling in every other target that we have, and only two or three targets have had 6,000 meters. Everything else is probably 2,000 or 3,000 meters. So you know, between now and the time we come to production, I'm hoping that I'm talking to you and saying, well, listen, our second stage of development of this project is that we're going to go to 200,000 ounces. We see lots of potential for growth here, not only in Brazil, but also in Argentina. And I can assure you, you know, with Quebec, with 30% of our resource accounting for a 20-year mine life of 5 million tons per annum, you know, we're already contemplating a second phase that'll take us up to 10 million tons once we get that built. But, you know, so these, again, it's all about finding the asset. And with Brazil, you know, when I came up with the idea of doing vanadium in Brazil, people thought I was nuts. And the reality is why did we go to Vanadium in Brazil? We knew Brazil, we knew the jurisdiction, but we knew that this was a first tier asset and best of breed asset. And the reality is, I think we have a best of breed asset with Brazil, with Monte do Carmo as well. And that's critical. Having the best assets in the top 1, 2%, 3%, you'll never go wrong with that, good or bad market.
That's great. Thanks,
Mark. That's fantastic, Mark. And so, you know, just in terms of like big picture here and a lot of great takeaways, but just that aspect of what you're hunting for, it's these tier one assets, best of breed assets. You know, it just comes back to when you have the right asset. Now, just final question, you clearly finding the right asset, you need the right team around it. Maybe just a final comments on just the team and what, you know, why, you know, what you've already done and, you know, and why, you know, how you guys have managed this great chemistry.
Well, we've been working together for 20 years. You know, so we trust each other. We know each other. We know the strengths. We know the weaknesses of each other. And the reality is that we're all trying to row the boat in the right direction. And that's complicated in its own right. But I'd say to you that you know, each of the team members that we have, again, very, very knowledgeable, very experienced. And they've done it before with far more complex projects than we have today. So from that perspective, highly, highly confident that you know, this project will come in on budget, probably, you know, under budget, probably within, you know, 16 months that we're targeting, pretty comfortably. So this is not, you know, particularly in Brazil, it is not a sophisticated plant. It is not a sophisticated process. It's a pretty straightforward process, which is why we've been able to really have a low CapEx compared to our peers. But you know, the team have done it before. They'll do this one, I think, a lot easier than we did the previous projects we've owned.
Mark, a very big thank you for joining us today, and congrats on the funding. And just to highlight, so Cerrado Gold is so just with respect to valuation, trading on 0.17 times price to NAV, which is a deep discount to peers, both developer peers, which are at 0.4 times, and junior producer peers, which is at 0.56 times. And Cerrado is on track to grow production 211% over the next 3 years. Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for your time and attention, and very, very happy to have your time. So really, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, guys. Thank you for joining us.